Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
All right, everyone, welcome back to One Broken Mom. I'm going to read my introduction for today's guest, and I am going to tell you right away, it's beautifully done, and I take zero credit for it. When I was preparing for what I wanted to say and how I wanted to introduce Craig onto the show, this is wonderfully done. And it sounds amazing because he's also a writer, which I can, you know, respect a lot. Reading his memoir, I was like, okay, I see a writing style here that's kind of, simpatico with my own, you know, my own personalities and things like that. And so, I'd like for you guys to listen here as I introduce to you today who we're talking to. Craig Miller is a member of the Massachusetts Coalition for Suicide Prevention and the American Association of Suicidology, and he is trained in both Safe Talk and Assist. When Craig was 15 years old, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, and psychiatrists at New Hampshire Hospital determined that the rituals and behaviors associated with Craig's OCD consumed about 95% of his waking hours. His compulsions spanned the entire spectrum of categorized behaviors, including washing, checking, counting, and self-harming. His counting rituals were among his most intrusive, as he would spend hours performing complex equations in his mind to avoid certain numbers while favoring others. At times, he spoke backwards after each sentence to reverse the intent of the words. He even performed ritualistic prayers to satisfy an irrational fear of God. Aside from these behaviors, Craig's most prominent compulsion was the need to collect scraps of paper he found on the ground. As he walked home from school each day, he collected pieces he saw along the way. He carefully flattened out their wrinkled creases and folded them up into his pocket. For years, he lived in a constant state of fear and depression, isolated from the world under the complete control of his OCD and the anxiety associated with it. But despite the overwhelming power OCD had over Craig, there was one thing that was off limits to his intrusive thoughts and compulsive behavior: writing. As a result, Craig began writing constantly, expressing his pain through song lyrics and poetry. He carried a pen with him always. And more often than not, he used the scraps of paper he collected on the side of the road to write his words. By the time he reached 21 years old, his life's traumas, as well as his battle with mental health issues, had taken a toll on him. And one night, while sitting on the edge of a rented bed, he attempted to end his life. For 3 days that followed, he lay in the intensive care unit, fighting a battle to start over. His triumph over this battle would prove to change his life forever. Today, Craig is free from OCD and the mental illness that once plagued him. He has found his peace in his life events and overcome the odds to leave his past behind. But despite everything he has broken ties with, writing has been the one thing to remain with him throughout it all. After self-publishing his memoir, This Is How It Feels, in July of 2012, Craig joined the Massachusetts Coalition for Suicide Prevention and began speaking out about his suicide attempt and his battles with mental health issues. Since then, he has shared his story with hundreds of people, speaking at bookstores, charity events, and public events, as well as at the Massachusetts Suicide Prevention Conference. He has also written blogs for the American Association of Suicidology's Attempt Survivor blog. Craig's insight into his mental health issues and the steps he took to overcome them has not only helped those who also struggle, but has provided valuable information to the professionals in the mental health field as well. In January of 2013, Craig gave a filmed interview where he talks in depth about these areas. This interview has been used in training programs for mental health clinicians and is planned to be rolled out nationwide. So it is with great pleasure and honor to welcome you, Craig, to the show and talking with me today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's again, I couldn't have said that more beautifully. And I felt like that was an entire, an entire span that needed to be expressed right there. And it's, like I said, it's clear, you know, writer to writer. Like I love the use of words and definitely of poetry and what you have to say. And so, you know, for everybody that's offline here that doesn't know, we've been messaging each other for quite some time, expressing mutual admiration for the work that we do in these fields and stuff like that. And so this has been a conversation in the works for quite a while. And so it's been, it's awesome to, you know, like I said, to be able to see you and your beautiful room there. You're out on the East Coast, right? So we're separated by 3 hours right now. Yeah. So, you know, today, let's just start with this thing. What's it like for you living during a pandemic right now? I mean, we're recording this, it's mid-May for historical purposes. And, you know, what kind of things have you been addressing and dealing with, you know, with stay-at-home orders and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I'm in Massachusetts, a little bit outside Boston. And, you know, I have a full-time career, a day job, nerd work, I call it. it's my fake life. My real life is mental health stuff. But so I have to continue working. I've been working from home for almost 2 months now. My children have been home from school. My wife is a school teacher, so she's been home. And still, everyone's still working. And the first few weeks, man, it was, I'm telling you, it was difficult. It was very, very, very difficult. Very difficult. I was just so overwhelmed. The stress of it and trying to do my job from home, realizing that the company I work for is likely not going to do too well through a pandemic, being in consumer sales and things like that. But so it was very stressful. And then the other hard part was that my kids, you know, mommy and daddy are home, and my kids didn't realize, like, couldn't comprehend, because they're young, that we're actually working. And you can't come in and every 10 minutes and tell me a story about the, you know, the cartoon you just watched. So it was really, really stressful. But then once I got a handle on it, I'm like, you know what? I got to make a decision of how I'm going to go through this. It's not going to change. It's how it's going to be. So how am I going to deal with it? How are we going to deal with it? And I spoke with my wife and I'm like, you know, this could actually probably be the best summer of our entire lives if we want it to be. We're home with no real responsibility outside of the house and outside of our careers. There's no checklist of things we have to do outside of it. It's just us, and let's be together as a family. And that we really trying to do that, and it changes everything. It changes everything. Mm-hmm. And I do my best to stay very consistent with keeping myself moving. I get up, take a shower. I change everything. I literally change you made a comment about my room. I changed this office because I didn't like the way it looked. I've been painting the walls in the house because I just can't look at them anymore. So like, I just want to keep things moving. But yeah, getting dressed and getting up and doing stuff and keeping my mind active is huge, huge. Mm-hmm. Because you can very easily feel stagnant.
Yeah. Is there anything about this experience that's been triggering for you? Because I know a lot of people that are struggling with this, you know, are finding that there's this sense of confinement and trapped feeling and, you know, all this that is actually teasing out histories they didn't even know they were connected to, because it's so different, right? Like we're all in like this, we're plunged back into childhood, really, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're not in charge anymore, which is the way, you know, we grew up, right? When you're a kid, right, you're not in charge. You're at the, you know, you have to do what your parents tell you to do and you don't have a lot of choices. And so for some people that, you know, have these feelings that like, God, this feels a little bit like, you know, I don't know why it feels weird. And it's because you're back to when you were a kid and you weren't right in control of your things. And so I've noticed with some people, you know, that they it's kind of drawing out little traumas that they didn't know about, and their behaviors are kind of retro back to how they might have felt about being in the situation when they were a kid with a parent that said, no, you can't go outside. You can't see your friends. You're grounded. I mean, it feels like being grounded and stuff. So have you gone through any of that, like those mental exercises of feeling
You know, I have not, and only because, let me explain, only because I have been there without a pandemic for so long and so many times and gone through the cycles. And I just wrote a post on Facebook that I put up kind of emphasizing that. Like, it's almost like if you were to take someone right now and say, you know what, pay attention to the pandemic, everything that's going on, the fact that we're alone, you can't interact with people the way you used to. Everything is a challenge. Everything's difficult. Even going to the grocery store, working from home, getting up and getting dressed every day is a challenge for a lot of people, taking a shower every day. And my point was, that's what depression feels like. Mm-hmm. Like that, what you're probably experiencing is a piece of depression. And that, to my point, was that it is. I've been there. I've done it. This is, to me, it's not triggering. I've been down there. I've been in much worse. So this is initially the stress with, you know, the uncertainty, let me say, the uncertainty was really difficult to get past, you know, mm-hmm. to wrap my arms around it. And I had been aware of this coming for a couple of months. I have a very close friend and who's big on this and was watching it from a couple months before it actually got to the United States. And so I was preparing myself in my head for what it might be. And the first weeks of uncertainty were pretty difficult, but then I made a decision to move on and mm-hmm. do the best I can with it.
Right. Right. It's an interesting correlation there to the depression. You know, I kind of also think too, that this whole thing is, you know, drawing a really like powerful, connection back to mental health, you know, and not, you know, seeing everybody experience mental health and mental wellness challenges kind of unified worldwide, right? And not because I think that this was a great idea to have a pandemic to do this, but, you know, it's sometimes these huge shifts, big moves that you have to get in order to kind of like push consciousness in a direction that you want it to go. And so now everybody knows, like, you know, and I've sat there and I'm like, if you want to know what it's like to be in an emotionally abusive relationship, look at what's going on outside around you. Like, mm-hmm. you know, some of the behaviors that we've seen out of people are what some people deal with their partners all the time. And you know, and that feeling that you have of like, I don't like being like, I don't like the way this feels. Well, that's, you know, we're seeing it at such a scale that everybody gets to experience it, sadly, but right. yet there is an enlightenment that comes from the group of, oh mm-hmm. crap. Like, and I can see how it, you know, maybe understand how it feels, but also how powerful it is and how, when some people have and address that or deal with it at a larger scope, how much harder it is to overcome that, you know what right. I mean? Like a sense of compassion for that.
I have to hope that people will take something from this and drive a positive change. I mean, it has to, there's so much conflict going on and so much ignorance. It's infuriating and both heartbreaking at the same time. And, If this doesn't drive some sort of collective change, I'm afraid of what it will actually take to make that happen. Right. So I think people like you yourself with the podcast and your message and other people in wellness and mental health, this is like an opportunity to pounce on it and make it happen and drive a change. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I noticed that for myself, you know, a lot of people really stepped into this like from day one, and I, you know, I was working on my book. So I, you know, I had to make a choice like, okay, I need to finish this. Like, I can't let that go because that's a seed that needs to be planted and it needs to spend some time in the dirt to grow. So I can't delay that, or I just delay, you know, also I had a deadline.
It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. It was kind of a big deal. Kind of needed to figure out how to get that one going. So anyways, so I feel like I'm a little late coming back into it, but it was all the plan. I'm like, you know what, listen, I'm going to honor what works for me. And I have all those balls. Cause like, you know, I do have a day job too. I work in a nursing agency, during a pandemic, and tell me what you think. Right. Like it's been nutty there. Plus doing that. And like you said, like working at home and having two teenagers, you know, that now see and understand, like after them watching me getting up at 3:30, 4:00 in the morning, working, getting done, watching conferences happen and video stuff, they definitely have this sense of, I don't get asked to, you know, stop what I'm doing very rarely, and that they tiptoe around the house. But it's that awareness is like, oh, thank God, you guys finally figured out I have a job.
Yeah. You know?
But I'm with you. Like, I think that this is large enough to do something like that. It won't be successful across the board. I mean, that's the other thing I think people have to like understand is like, you know, it's a bell curve. You know, there's always going to be people that this does no change to them. Mm-hmm. Good or bad, there'll be a big bulk of people wondering what that change should be. And then there'll be people on the other end of that bell curve know exactly which direction we should be going, will be leading us there.
Right.
Right? But we have this shift right here in the center of everybody going, this is weird. Something's going to be different. I can't imagine how, you know, help me understand where we go with that. And so I feel like for me, I'll be kind of coming in as we kind of got, you know, move out of it, I'll try to do my best. You know, I guess one thing that would be interesting is kind of going back into your history and stuff is, let's just kind of walk through, you know, you seem like everything's great now, right? You don't seem like the kind of guy that would sit on a bed at 21 years old and swallow 250 pills.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What changed?
I did. So it's, yeah, I changed. I think for
well,
me,
interview's done.
Yeah. Yeah. Where do I start? So, I think, you know, growing up for me was extremely difficult, extremely difficult. My first time I considered suicide, I was 8 years old, and, I was home alone, and I had seen this. I was doing the dishes, and in the sink was a chef's knife. And the thought of using it to hurt myself was very, very attractive. And I stood there in front of the sink and cried my eyes out alone, because to me at 8 years old and all the way through my teenagers, but especially when I was young, it was like my parents were divorced when I was younger. This is very typical life, you know, what most of us experience. My parents were divorced when I was like 2 years old. Both were alcoholics. My mother remarried several times. The husband she stayed with the longest was my stepfather at 8, and he was an alcoholic. A lot of jealousy issues. My mother had undiagnosed mental health issues. I was being sexually abused by a mentally handicapped man in the neighborhood, which was really difficult. What drives it, I think, into more darker circumstances for me is that the majority of the instances that happened occurred in a crawl space beneath my house. So it was like that. I'm in these like incredibly dark moments where this stuff is happening to me, and I can hear my family's footsteps on the floor above me because I'm under the house, and you know, it was a lot. What was worse to that, though, is that I was being picked on and bullied for being abused and molested. It was like all the kids, because this guy had tried it with a bunch of kids in the neighborhood who also went to the same school I did. They were different than me. They were able to say no, walk away, whatever, better skills. I have no idea, but they made it out okay. I didn't. And they knew about it. They knew what was going on. It was like everyone I wished didn't know about it did. And everyone I wanted to know about it didn't know about it. So I was being bullied for this whole thing on top of it. And then I started to develop these mental health issues with obsessive compulsive disorder, where I started to believe as I walked to school in the morning that I had to stay perfectly centered on the sidewalk. If I went a little bit left or a little bit right, then something bad would happen. The day would be imbalanced and anything that went wrong would be my fault. And it would take me sometimes 30 minutes for a 10-minute walk because I'd have to back up and walk backwards because I had to like reverse the process, and a lot of really, really powerful thoughts. And one of the things about OCD is, you know, it's irrational. You know full well this doesn't make sense, but you are powerless to control it. So I have all these things happening in my mind. And I think for me, one of the biggest things that I struggled with at that time is that I had no trust in anything around. And the two things that I think are key elements to wellness from my perspective is trust and belief. I think that's where we find balance. And what represents trust for me is our minds, right? We trust in the things that we can rightly predict the outcome to. 2 + 2 = 4. We know how things work. And belief is very different though, right? Belief to me is almost like an emotion. It's innate. It's within us. It's indescribable, like trying to say what love is. And that to me happens in our hearts. So all the stuff that was going on to me was like, this is reality. This is real. I'm being molested. I'm being abused. I'm being emotionally abused. I have no friends. I'm being beat up. I didn't trust in life. I didn't trust in my parents. I didn't trust in my peers. I didn't trust in the people in my neighborhood. And I reached a point where I couldn't trust in my own mind. Mm-hmm. And that to me was like, if this, you have to understand, that's my introduction to life, right? That's what the world is to me. And I had enough wherewithal, even at 8 years old, to be like, this is not how it should be. I know this is not how it should be. This doesn't make sense. And I had no trust in anything around me. And that's what really drove me to just want to die. And as I stood in my kitchen and I had this knife in the sink and I'm thinking about what it could do to hurt me, what kept me from doing it was this belief in my heart. This part of me that just said, Craig, hold on. Just hold on. It's going to be okay. It'll all make sense someday. And I believe that. And I remember sliding down the cabinet and laying on the kitchen floor and laying the knife next to me and just sobbing my eyes out, thinking I didn't really want to die, but I didn't really want to live. Mm-hmm. But that belief in my heart, that's what kept me going. And that's what really drove me forward through all of it. So it continued to get worse beyond that, right? I mean, my first consideration of suicide was 8 years old. It never left me. It never. Right. So that was the way I describe it is like suicide was the solution to every issue I had. And it was the fallback. If something went wrong, I have a way out. And as dangerous as it might sound, it was also the way I convinced myself to get to the next day. Because I thought, like, you know what, I'll give tomorrow a chance. If tomorrow doesn't work, I have a way out. And that kind of made it easier for me, which sounds dangerous, but when you're dealing with someone who's in crisis, right, it sounds dangerous. But no, that really, really helped me. It was like a carrot on the end of the string sort of thing. Like, I have a way out if it doesn't work, so why not try? Yeah. And I just kept pushing it forward in my own mind to the next day, to the next day, to the next day, and kept trying different things and doing what I could to get well. By the time I reached teenage, I was about 13, 14. We moved away from the neighborhood I grew up in, and we moved to this small town outside of the city. And I looked at it like a chance, like, this is my chance. This is rags to riches. I'm starting over. No one will know I'm the victim. No one will know I'm the one to make fun of and bully or anything. They will not know my past. And I it worked. It really worked. It was crazy. Like, I joke about it, like the boys thought I was cool and the girls thought I was cute. And I had never experienced anything like that in my life. And the prettiest girl in the town, it was a very small town. There's like 8 girls in our class. So take it for what it is. The prettiest girl in that town asked me out. And I was like, oh my God, man, that was like crazy. Never, like, what is going on? You know, I went from like the victim and the one to pick on by anybody, boys and girls, to being like the hottest girl in the town wants to date me. What's going on? And I fell completely in love with her, right out of the gate. And, the problem is because I had done so much, which I think is good that I had done so much to try to leave my past behind. What I didn't do was deal with it in any way whatsoever. I just buried the suicidal thoughts and I buried the OCD and I tried to hide all these mental health issues that I was having still, regardless that I had moved out of that environment. I was still living with my mom and stepfather and all that. And eventually that stuff caught up with me and I was hospitalized for a suicide attempt at 15. And this girl who like changed my life broke up with me. Mm-hmm. And that absolutely devastated me. I mean, I'm 44 years old, married with children. And I use that in part of my story because it was so significant. I can tell you right now as a 44 year old man that 15 year old kid knew what love was. And the love I felt and had in my heart was no less significant than I feel now for my wife. It doesn't matter that I was 15 years old. And I think one of the things that affected me so much from that breakup was that the people around me, including myself, everyone around me was like, Craig, you'll find someone else. Like, it's your first girlfriend. What are you so devastated about? What's the big deal? There'll be someone else, you know, kind of minimizing the whole thing. What I didn't realize at the time and what I didn't get and nobody got until years later was that it wasn't this girl, right? It had nothing to do with this teenage girl who told me she loved me and everything. It wasn't that she was soft and she was the first person who touched me and didn't hurt me when she touched me, you know, significant mm-hmm. things that I had first put a lot of value in. And then when I was able to wipe that away and look back, it wasn't her at all. It was the fact that for the first time in my life, I felt like maybe I could trust life. Maybe it will be okay. Maybe this is the reason I held on and maybe love is real. And I let my guard down. And her breaking up with me was, the significance of it was life saying, no, you can't let your guard down, man. This is going to hurt. You're going to get hurt. And it's real. And that just devastated me. That was like, it had nothing to do with the relationship. It was this fact that I let my guard down. I believed in it. It came and stabbed me really, really hard. Right. So that just evolved. That was like a snowball effect. And by the time I was 16, I left my home. I felt that it was better for me to be out of that environment with my mother and stepfather than it would be somewhere else. And again, nothing I advocate for. It wasn't a smart decision for me to do what I did. I didn't actually like leave home and move or run away or anything. I just stopped coming home as often until eventually I stopped coming home. And I had a friend who had a this sort of like dilapidated barn that was offset from his house in the woods. And I lived there. I just stayed there as often as I could. And when his parents were at work and stuff, I'd go in and do my laundry and get some food and go back in the garage. And I did that for a few years, a lot of years through most of my teens. And we would play music. So that was like what helped me through my teens. You know, I can tell you the value in the story of me being a kid at 8 years old and not trusting in life was that the reason I didn't tell people what was going on, the reason I didn't open up about my mental health issues, and especially the abuse, was that I didn't trust anyone around me to do what I thought was right, even at 8 years old. My dad was a severe alcoholic with major anger issues, Vietnam vet, Marine. If I told him I was being sexually abused, it would have been a murder, right? I didn't want that. I just wanted it to end. I wanted it to stop. So there was no one I could trust in to react the way I wanted them to react. And there was no one I felt comfortable enough with to have a conversation where they would understand how I wanted them to react. And that's why I always kept it inside myself. What helped me the most when I was in teenage was this dream of being a musician. I mean, it was everything. It wasn't singing in a band. It wasn't, and then looking back on it, like to me, it was like, yeah, I'm going to make a life for myself and people are going to hear what I have to say in the music. And that was like the illusion of the passion that drove me. Looking back at it, it wasn't that at all. What it really was, I thought for a while, was, being able to sing and express myself. And maybe it was the writing. Maybe I wrote songs and lyrics because that was training me for writing and it was an outlet. And in the end, I realized, you know what, that what drove me through all my teens and what got me through it wasn't just this dream. It was developing an ability to connect with people. That's what I always wanted. That's what I still want. You know, that's everything to me. That's brings value to my existence and my life, just to connect with that one person. It doesn't matter. It's just the connection is huge.
Yeah.
So that was the driver through all of my years and my high school years and playing in music. But again, I wasn't doing anything to deal with it. And I was hospitalized 5 times in my teens for mental health issues and suicide attempts. I didn't let anyone really help me because I always looked at it like my friends and family can't help me. I can't help me. How is this stranger going to help me? How is the system going to help me? And then I'd go and meet with a doctor who was teaching me how to breathe through anxiety. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You want me to breathe? Like breathing is what? Like my life is falling apart. You want me to breathe? So it didn't make sense to me. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I believe in that now, but at the time that was my rationale. Like what? I'm not talking to these people. So that's how it was for me. And some of the other things that really drove me away from getting help and receiving help and accepting help was some of the things that happened and didn't happen. When I took medication piles of medication every day. I took pills for obsessive compulsive disorder, pills for anxiety, depression, pills for the side effects of those pills. And even though I had no home or anything, I always took them with discipline. I had a watch and I'd set my time and carry my pills with me and I'd take them everywhere. One of the big problems was I was taking them with the visual that something was wrong with me. I'm taking pills because I'm broken. I'm taking medicine because I'm broken. And this is the only way that anything's going to work. And I used to visualize like the scenes in movies where someone just pours out pills. They're about to have a heart attack, and they're pouring out the pills as fast as they can and getting them in. They're like, oh, yeah, I got to go, you know? And it, like, that was my visual. That was how I took it. And no one ever stopped and said to me, hey, you know, there's a chemical in your brain called serotonin. It's mm-hmm. responsible for making you feel well. And this medicine, this is going to go into you, and it's going to find those receptors that uptake that serotonin, and it's going to block them. And you'll build more serotonin, and you'll feel better. So every time you take these pills, I want you to think of that. I want you to hold them in your hand and imagine them going into your body and doing exactly what they're supposed to do, and give intent to them to do the right thing, and let that work. You know, imagine the power of visualizing that versus I'm taking them because I'm broken, mm-hmm. because there's something wrong with me, right? So there was things like that that were just driving me in the opposite direction, inadvertently, and nobody's fault, right? One of the other key things I think were so important during that time, and I'm telling you this because I want you to understand my mindset, which drove me to change and why changing me was so important, right?
Yep.
One of the key things I think was important is I can't tell you how many doctors and clinicians in emergency room people I sat with for mental health crisis who asked me, do you want to die? And I get that. That's an important question. We need to ask that. I fully support that. But no one ever once asked me if I wanted to live. And for someone who struggles with suicide as much as I have and had, there's a very, very different question there, right? Mm-hmm. Saying, no, I don't want to die doesn't mean I'm okay. It just mm-hmm. means that, you know, if this is suicide, if this is it, this is my bottom, I'm going to act on it. Saying, no, I don't want to die doesn't mean I'm okay. It just might mean I'm 1 inch above the bottom. It means I'm still that 8-year-old kid lying on the kitchen floor with a knife next to me. So saying, do you want to live? And saying, yes, I want to live. That's up at the sky. I mean, that's a whole different world. That's a whole different concept. I want to be engaged in life. I want to understand life. I want to take smart risks and fail and learn. You know, things like that's life, right? That's living. I was never asked that. And I never had the opportunity to say that or think that. I just thought, no, I don't want to die meant that I was okay enough that I could be out of crisis. And that was a good enough answer for the emergency room doctors and the clinicians and my family and friends. And it was a good enough answer for me. And it drove me to believe, subconsciously believe, that 1 inch above the bottom means I'm okay. And this is the standard. And this is how I live. And this is being here means life is okay. Well, no, it's not. And that was not accepting, not thinking deep enough to realize that wanting to live is a very different thing. That kind of inadvertently pushed me down and kept me at that one place above the bottom to say the same mindset that I had when I was a kid, that if this is what life is, then I don't want to live it. I don't want anything to do with it. So there were a lot of things like that that really inadvertently pushed me in a lower direction, right? And that, so when I speak now in mental health and conferences and things like that, these are the things I kind of bring to the table to help people see it a different way. Eventually, I had reached a point where in my 20s that I just couldn't do it anymore. I mean, I was tired. It was one painful thing after another, and every opportunity and every chance I gave to life to get better, it really didn't. And it wasn't devastating. I think what was so dark and so difficult about my attempt in my 20s, the big one, was nobody saw it coming. It wasn't an act of desperation. It wasn't an act of emotion. It wasn't crisis. It wasn't an outburst. It was very calm. I was very much at peace. It was almost like I reached a point where I just wanted to close the curtain and bow out and step off the stage. So it was really hard for the people around me to not see that when I attempted to say, wow, usually we see it, you know, all the signs are there, but he didn't show anything. So I spent the next 3 days after I did that, in the intensive care unit. You know, they had needles in my skin and monitors and tubes in my nose and throat. I was tied to the bed because I was fighting everybody who came in to help me. Mm-hmm. On the third day, my brother comes in, and my brother is I want to tell you, I get emotional during all this stuff, and I talk about this for years. I've been talking about this, and it's not emotional like it hurts me. It's emotional because I'm very connected to it, and there's part of me that recognizes it as something beautiful and proud, right? So that's where this comes from. Mm-hmm. My brother comes in, and now he's a very different personality than me. I'm all emotion and heart and tattoos. I had long hair, and I'm singing in a band, and he's super professional, this, you know, $1,000 suit with monogram sleeves, and very fact and logic and super business sense, and can make very difficult decisions very easily. So when our communication on things like life, that it doesn't line up, right? We have really awkward conversations. So I'm sitting and I'm laying in the bed, and they're about to release me to a mental health facility for evaluation. It's the last day. And my brother asks me, it's very quiet, and he leans in and he says, what's it going to take to make you want to stay? So, yeah, that's a big question. The reason it catches me every time. The reason it does is because I didn't know what's it going to take to make me want to stay. I could have given you 1,000 answers of why I wanted to die, but I couldn't give you one of why I wanted to live. And that was really, really hard. So I let over the next few weeks, that question, his question, become my question. What's going to make me want to stay? And in that was this recognition, like the things you would think, oh, is it family? Is it a good relationship? Is it financial security? Is it feeling valued in life and valued by others? No. It was none of that. It was none of that at all. What for me would make me want to stay in my 20s was just being okay. The bare minimum of existence, to wake up in the morning and say, I'm okay with the day. I'm okay with being alive. I'm not afraid of what's going to happen next. That's all I wanted. But recognizing that and seeing that in myself made me realize that, man, I really had reached the lowest point in my existence. I was at the bottom. I was truly at the bottom. And I knew, like, okay, if I'm going to live, then I'm going to live. I'm going to do this but I'll tell you, like, something has to change, because I can't keep living the way I am. I'm never get off the bottom. I'll never get out of here. So I looked at, like, you know, okay, in a condensed version of the process, what needs to change? What needs to be different in my life? And I went through all the things that you would expect. Well, I wished I wasn't molested. I wish I wasn't abused. I wish I wasn't bullied. I wish I didn't have mental health issues to the extent that I did, and all the things that had gone through that. And I realized as I went through this list mentally through months of my life, I realized that, you know what, all those things had changed. They were all different. I wasn't that kid under the house anymore. I wasn't hiding in my bed from my mother's violent outbursts, walking room to room and breaking furniture and everything. That had changed. Life had changed. But the one thing that hadn't was me. I hadn't changed. So the reality is I needed to change and wanted to change so badly that I was willing to die for it. That's what happened. Strip away the circumstances, strip away the story. I needed to change so badly I was willing to die for it. Why hadn't I changed? And that's really a two-part answer. The first is I liked it. And it's a hard one to say. I liked it. It was mine. It was all that I knew. And I could say with someone, I could look someone in the eyes and say with absolute certainty that you have no idea what it's like to be me. And I was right. I was right. And I knew that. That was all I had. That was my identity. Don't take that away from me. So I didn't want to give it up because I liked it. I thought my writing, my best writing, came from my darkest places. Mm-hmm. And I would, like, let myself fall into these spots just to write well. Like, what is that about? So the other part to that is I was afraid. I was scared. What's it like on the other side? What's it like to be confident, to stand in front of a room of 1,000 people and talk about your heart and mind and life and suicide and love? Like, no, I couldn't do any of that. I was scared to death. But the reality was, when I really thought about it, is that I had absolutely nothing to be afraid of. And that to me is a key message to anyone who feels suicidal or is struggling with suicidal ideation. there is absolutely nothing left to be afraid of. That's as bad as it gets. That's mm-hmm. the worst. You're at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And any decision you make to improve yourself, any decision you make to think differently or feel differently or act differently is only going to take you in a better place. If anything, it will take you nowhere, but it's not going to get worse. And there was really nothing left to be afraid of. So that is what really drove me to seeing things a little differently. And then I realized in this process that what is it that makes me up? And it really comes down to that trust and belief, the mind and heart that I spoke about earlier, is that, you know, I didn't trust in life. I didn't trust in the outcome, but I believed with everything I am. I believe that there's a purpose and there's a meaning and there's reason. And it, whether or not that philosophy sits well with anybody, it doesn't matter. I'm going to believe that because that's what I need to let me go forward. That brings purpose and meaning to me, and it means I'm no longer a victim. And if I believe that there's reason for things we experience in life, and inarguably, if anything, those reasons are at the very least to teach us something. Not to say there's some magical, mystical, behind-the-scenes script going on. There's an opportunity for us to learn. Then that's enough for me. So what did I learn? And I looked at the things I had gone through in my life. What I had always believed in my heart, this wasn't just a huge shift. This is something that I felt all along, believing in dreams and believing in myself and reason and purpose. I just let it take hold, and I let it drive me. I brought it to the forefront. And in doing that, I was like, okay, if there's, what are the things I went through in life that hurt me the most? The biggest one was molestation. Well, what the hell reason is there for that? And if I literally were to list them out, like all the things that left me with self-confidence issues, trust issues, relationship issues, mental health issues, just significant damaging things. Well, if I'm allowed to take what I want from that experience, are those the things I want to take with me? Is that what I want to bring? Are those the attributes I want to bring with me for the rest of my life to contribute to who I am as a person and personality and the struggles I have? No, there's no value in that for me. I gain nothing from that. But if there is anything to gain in the experiences that I went through regarding the sexual abuse, to me, it was compassion. And there's value in that. And the way I write about it in my book is that compassion is to see the hurt in the eyes of another, no matter how badly we are hurt ourselves. If going through that experience is what gave me or allowed me to have that level of compassion in my heart, then it's worth it. Mm-hmm. It's not dark. It's not ugly. And I take away that dark power from it, and I say it's mine. And I went through it, and I took that class, and I freaking aced it, and I got a diploma, and I don't have to go back. I don't ever have to go back. I will never have to learn a hard lesson in compassion again. Because I did it. Mm-hmm. And I looked at all the other stuff I had gone through. My parents, my dad, who continuously was filled with broken promises one after another. I think from that, I learned the value of commitment and sticking with what you're doing and do what you say you're going to do. Mental health issues, bullying, right? Like, what did I learn from that? Well, for me, I think it taught me a watchdog instinct. It taught me to look someone in the eye and know right away if they have pure intent and if their best and my best interest is in the heart of them. And I can read that. I think all of us can, right? But I'm going to attribute mine to being bullied because it makes bullying not so dark, right? Mm-hmm. And then mental health issues, I think, is one of the most significant ones. You know, what, my God, the struggles I've had in the hospitalizations and the nights where I just lay completely flat on the floor, bawling my eyes out because I physically am unable to stand up from the emotional breakdown that I'm having. But what did I gain from that? And I think it, for me to embrace it and accept it the way I have and own it, like take control and own it, is that for mental health issues, to me, is probably one of the most direct and beautiful paths to self-discovery I could have ever imagined. Mm-hmm. I think about how fortunate I was to have had years of my life where I was forced in one way, but given the opportunity in another way to be completely inside myself. For every thought that came into my mind being stopped analyzed, broken apart, compartmentalized, reformed, put back out. Like I lived inside myself with mental health issues for years. So many people get up and go through their lives and all the way through, and they never stop to realize who they are and how they think and how they process stuff. And that to me was like, wow, this taught me more than I think I ever could have got from anything else. So long answer to your question, what changed? It was me. It was looking at all that stuff and finding value in it and saying, look, these are the ingredients that make me up. These are the opportunities I've gone through and the experiences that I've had. How am I going to make that work for me? How am I going to embrace it and turn it and make it my own? I have to do that. That's survival. I have to do that. And in doing that, I gave myself so much power over my life, over my feelings, over how I view things, how I want to view things. And I want to be clear, it's not like this disillusioned, I'm going to see it ribbons and ponies. I mean, there's a lot of work that happened for me to view it that way. And in doing that, I've learned to like embrace difficult circumstances that come into my life now and find real value in them as mm-hmm. I'm going through them. Mm-hmm.
So many things running through my head right now. God, just give me a second here to figure out like how I want to, first of all, resiliency. I mean, the last thing you're talking about there. I've mentioned this before, that resiliency really is a privilege, especially when you experience it, you know how powerful it is in your life to have it, and then realize how difficult it is for some people to ever muster it. Right? Like,
right.
Everything that you're describing of being able to see the upside to every circumstance just truly is hard for some people, mm-hmm. you know, to do that. And, you know, I'm sitting here as you're talking about that. Of course, my brain is, I'm always solving problems. So as you're talking about like that part of it, I thought, God, you know, how amazing it would be to, again, not ribbons and unicorns and bows on everything, but like how amazing it would be to teach people the skills. You and I both have these skills, right? Like I go back, like I'm gonna kind of wrap around a circular yeah. conversation of what you just said, but you know, going back to what writing meant for you and what you really wanted it as a teenager, like that connects. Like I felt my skin tingle there, you know, listening to that, because you know, I have journals from when I was a kid, and when I was, you know, because writing was how I escaped, you know, I was trapped in a box and I felt like the only person that could hear me would be the people that could read what I had to say. Mm-hmm. Right. Because they weren't listening to me. They weren't seeing me. And writing for me was, again, in this need to be seen and validated came out through, well, if I can't land with you communicating verbally, being in space with you, maybe I can find ways of connecting and understanding and reprocessing what I need through my words. And so my same thing, I wrote lyrics, I wrote poetry, yeah. I wrote stories, I wrote everything. I killed myself off in my stories over and over again as a child.
Wow.
That part, right? So, but storytelling is powerful, right? I think what we learn when we write is we are given a skill. Some of it we're probably born with, right? Some of us are born with the certain cells that make us artistic and creative and analytical. And some of us get a combination of all those things. Some of us get none of those things.
Right.
But when you have the skill of being able to see the story around you, and have you read Joseph Campbell's The Hero of 1,000 Faces?
I'm not, no.
Okay, so it's writer to writer. That is about the mythology, the origins of mythology, and the structure of mythological journeys and the hero's journey. And I have found through my life, my abilities to be able to move forward is to definitely look back as a hero's journey. And this thinking out loud, this is just me spitballing a comment yeah. here, is how powerful that could be to sit with people and show them how to write their story, because not everybody can. Like you and I, it comes natural.
Yeah.
Because we're writers. Right. Mm-hmm. But for some people that can't, like, it seems like, you know, again, just like if, you know, an exercise in understanding the value and the components of mythology, and to make yourself your own hero in your story, even with exactly. all the shit that happens. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. That's key. So I do a lot in that realm with helping people to find their story and And I've actually seen, like, this is a kind of a big thing in suicide prevention, where lived experience is being more and more embraced not in the United States, and more attempt survivors and people with mental health issues are given microphones. And I feel very, there's a few things I feel deeply passionate about and take a stand on, and this is one of them. I've seen so many people be given that microphone and get on the stage and tell nothing but horrific trauma that happened to them and the story. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? There's so much there. What did you learn? How are you able to stand there in front of me and tell me this story? That's the value in it.
Right. That's like, fucking heroic, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I'm with you. I think that, you know, the more we can train people and teach people on how to find the value in their own story and where the hero lies in them and what they actually learned, change that perspective, help them mm-hmm. change the perspectives. Absolutely huge, huge, yeah. Especially in lived experience in suicide prevention, mental wellness, and everything that goes around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, doing a little bit of research on my end for the work that I do, you know, I don't work with in the suicide world. You know, I actually work with businesses and entrepreneurs. And right mm-hmm. now there's a lot of entrepreneurs dealing with some heartbreaking conditions, losing that. Companies and stuff like that. Resiliency is what kind of gets, it allows you to bounce up off the bottom mm-hmm. and keep going forward. And so this whole concept of resiliency, of understanding, like, can it be taught? And it can be. Some people will struggle with it more due to serotonin. You know, they are seeing that there are brain differences in people that seem to be able to figure it out more quickly than others. Resiliency is something that we're given. Again, I it's a privilege, because if you have the right brain, to be honest, and you had secure adults, you have a far greater chance of actually having a natural resiliency to you. And if you didn't, you have more work to go to get to it, but it is doable with varying levels of degrees of success in there. And one of the key elements of that is to be able to see the story and to be able to understand the actions of moving forward in it. And so it is a positive outcome, but again, there is various levels for what people can actually, how quickly they can get there. And, you know, it's one of those things too, that I've seen that, like, people don't understand exactly what a privilege it really is, that there are literally people that are born to have it much more quickly, or had circumstances that make it come just much more natural. Right. And I see a lot of judgment. And also in the suicide world, like we talked a little bit before the interview, really about, you know, we used to just judge people for, you know, choosing to die by suicide as just being weak-minded or, you know, selfish or whatever the stupid, you know, fucking stigma words that we use to shame a person, you know, in that way. But it happens everywhere, that we just don't understand why some people can just bounce and some people can't. And so when you can, you tend to judge everybody that can around you as having some, you know, some deficiencies or defects or, you know, anything like you said, like, you're broken. You're obviously, this will never work, but it can work. Like, you can correct that, hard. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, one thing that you also said too, that just kind of, like, it was another moment that just kind of made my skin tingle here, was, you're right. Facing, you know, knowing that we're wired and designed to not die, like, that's the one base thing that if the brain's like, if there's anything I'm going to do today, it's to keep you from dying, Craig, me, Craig, everybody else, your brain is going to do whatever it takes. So if you have actually fucking looked at that and said, I'm not afraid to die, you have truly faced the ultimate fear, like the one thing that your brain is designed to keep you from doing. And if you do that with no fear and complete fearlessness, you are absolutely correct. There is nothing else scarier.
Right.
So like the upside of that, of like, if you can look at fear and say, I'm not afraid to die, well, shit, then you shouldn't be afraid of anything.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. How amazing. How, like you had mentioned, that people who can get resilience naturally are privileged in a sense. And I agree with you. I also think though, that we are even more privileged when we can struggle and overcome it and reach that point where we're overriding the biological instinct of survival talking ourselves out of suicide, which is like, I got very good at learning what I needed to hear to survive. Right. So there's that. And then, on top of it, if you can go through the things that a lot of us have gone through and struggled through and then develop that resiliency and get past it, that is like, you talk about the reward of fearlessness. How many people in their lives truly face fear and are able to have true fearlessness inside of them and look at anything around them and say, I'm okay with this and I'm going to go forward and I'm going to look life in the eyes, right? My greatest fear wasn't dying. It was living. Look life in the eyes and say, I'm coming. I'm doing it. I'm going. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like, I don't care how naturally resilient you are. That power of overcoming is a million times greater than the other side, right? So I think it's almost, we can put ourselves in a privileged category when we are able to come through it. And I think we can also put ourselves in a category where we now have a responsibility to help other people who are in circumstance and can't find their way out.
Oh yeah, 100%. And I think that's what I've, like, for me, that's been the purpose for me of realizing I do have something special here. In terms of, and I haven't dealt with the depths and the darknesses that you've dealt with, you know, my own hurdles and obstacles and all that stuff. But I've sat many times and just said, man, it's really shitty right now, but I know I'm going to be okay. And I've had people look at me like, how do you even know? It's like, it doesn't even matter how I know. Yeah. I just know. And I don't know. It's not like I have a crystal ball. I can't see the future ahead of me, but I just know every fucking time I'm coming back. And I'm coming back better because I know I have the ability to look back, find out everything that I needed to know through that experience. Like, what was this trying to teach me? Like, mm-hmm. I didn't want to have to go through an abusive relationship, but I did. And when I sat down there, what did that teach me? Not that this person's an asshole, whatever.
Right.
It happened. I'm here. What did I take from this? And, and I feel that too. Like it is like, that's the purpose is definitely like, okay, that bell curve. I know where I am on that ability to bounce back. And so that mm-hmm. to me, it's not my job, but it is like, it's my job. It's like, well, this is why, if you're given all these skills to be able to do this, it's because that there it's to be able to share them with other people who can't. And exactly. You know, right now, suicide or not, that we've got a big world of people struggling right now.
Oh yeah. 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 If you look at too what you've gone through to gain what you have and looking at the value in that, there's definitely a responsibility in it to try to help others find their way out too.
I think so. I mean, I think that's kind of an essence of humanity, you mm-hmm. know, in that.
You can choose to wear it. And you look at those experiences, you can choose to wear it as a scar. And something right. that hurt you, or you can wear it as a badge of honor and say, yeah, I did that. I went to, you know, emotional boot camp and I fucking made it. And right. I came out shining, you know? Yeah, I did. That's what happened to me. And look at what I learned from it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. 100%. Thank you for listening to part one of my interview with Craig Miller. Tune in next week and you'll hear the second half of our amazing discussion. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiqueercony.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercony, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.